You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast and another edition of Weekend Conversations. Each week, we'll take a deeper dive into an article or interview shared during the week. And joining me, as usual, is my co-host and co-producer of the Elevate Podcast, Mick Sloan. How's it going, Mick?
It's going well. How are you, Bob?
Good, other than flubbing that opening, which will be edited out and people won't be able to hear.
Yeah, we'll keep this in, though. So people won't hear the mistake, but they'll know.
They'll know it was there.
So what are we talking about?
So this week, we're going to be talking about yesterday's Friday Forward, which was called Imperfect Dynasty.
So this post is about the recent Apple documentary called The Dynasty, which is a pretty detailed retrospective on the reign of the New England Patriots, a team in the National Football League in the U.S. So the Patriots were the NFL's model franchise for about 20 years, from 2001 to 2020, winning 18 division titles and 6 Super Bowls in 20 seasons. So because you're a Patriots fan, I know why you watch this. So instead, I'll ask, what jumped out to you about the documentary to the point you wanted to write about it?
All right. Well, let me start with a couple of different things. One, like, huge disclaimer. And I know the rule that when you start talking sports, you lose, 50% of the audience. But I will tell you that, like, there are some pretty enduring lessons here from building organizations and leadership and not had to do with sports. However, the construct of sports, I think why there are so many leadership analogies is you have team dynamics, you have coaches and leaders. And I think there's a lot of well-run organization and teams that have been kind of doing things at a high level for a while that we can learn from. So that's the asterisk. I watched it because I knew the story. It's actually not a very positive story of the dynasty. I think a lot of people might think you'd watch it, like, in people in New England, but most of the players who sat down to the interviews have been pretty critical that, like, they sat down for hours and most of the stuff that was used was negative. And I think, maybe the producers had an angle that they wanted to do. So, look, I had a friend who was interviewed for it, who was part of the story, who was a doctor. And, this was the last 20 years. So I thought I would watch it. What I didn't think is that I would be referencing pieces of it in the business context in discussions for so many weeks after, and sort of how many parallels were going on in that world. And so I think one of the subplots that's really looked at is having these two star players, who produced a lot of winning together, and the coach winning as coach ever and winning as player ever. But, by the end, their relationship was pretty fractured or non-existent.
Yeah. And just to add to your disclaimer, so we're going to talk a lot about the relationship between Tom Brady, who was quarterback, and Bill Belichick, who was coach. And they were the only two people involved in the actual team who were there for all 20 years that the film covers. And, to your point, this isn't really about sports, because you could change some nouns and be talking about any kind of professional partnership. You could be talking about two musicians who work together, like, Lennon and McCartney with the Beatles. You could be talking about Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak with Apple. This is about
a great marriage, over 20 years or partnership. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is about relationships, and this is about, professional relationships in particular, and how those can be strong in moments and can have signs of deterioration, how you think back on them, how you take the good and the bad.
Yeah, and it's about ego and the danger of success and all kinds of interesting factors that we have talked about more. They just all come together in this story.
So in terms of both your own perspective as someone who followed the team, but also through the lens of the documentary, what do you think were some of the strengths and the weaknesses of that relationship between the two of them?
Look, the strengths as it started out were a ton of mutual respect. And I think, I've written about, or I talked about in one of my speeches, like, his decision to basically go with Brady after the star highest paid player in the league was out for 3 games came from because I think he saw this person who just would take feedback, would take improvement, would get better, wasn't the best athlete in the world, but he wouldn't make the same mistake twice. And Belichick is a teacher, kind of first and foremost. And I think he saw a student with an insatiable desire to learn. And that sort of fueled their relationship for years. Like, Belichick knew how to teach and knew the system, and this young kid was an absolute sponge and didn't make any of the same mistakes twice, and kind of took everything that the coaching staff was teaching him. And that worked. And, you know, one of the interesting things is in this is that, like, you know, environments change, people change, generations change. I think there was a lot of, like, the Patriot way in the system, and it worked until it didn't work. And when it didn't work spectacularly kind of in this. And that was one of the long running narratives too. Look, it is very hard in today's day and age to do the same thing and not adapt. And I think there was no adaptation, you know, over a certain amount of time as people changed, characters changed, and relationships changed. And I think, you know, one of the things for Brady that ultimately led to his leading, and look, you could argue both sides of this, is that he felt like at some point he had won over and over at a high level. And, you know, Belichick probably, you know, he doesn't have a lot of emotions. If you watch his press conferences or otherwise, and, like, there's a lot of talk that he may be on the spectrum, and that would actually make a lot of sense in terms of how he, because people try to emulate him, don't have a lot of success. I think he's authentically being who he is. It's not like a shtick. And a lot of people that have tried to replicate that really struggle. But he just, you know, he has these rules and he has this way of doing it, and there's no breaking it, and over and over. And I think after a while, like, you know, for Brady, it was like, look, I deserve a little slack. I deserve, like, I don't want to be an exception or whatever, but I don't deserve the same treatment as someone kind of who's a rookie, who's never proven anything on the team before. And that was sort of the model of the operation.
Yeah. So to put it really simply, it seems like the Patriot way, the Belichick way, it's things like, there's a lot of things like doing your job, not making the same mistake twice, being committed, keeping the long view. But I think that what's most crucial, and what sounds like the documentary really, really focuses on, is the idea that no person is bigger than the team. And what I think I want to focus on first with you is that there's a really interesting status dynamic and power dynamic element at play here that is applicable to any professional setting that you could possibly have, or even in a lot of personal relationships too. So, to set the scene for people who don't know much about Brady, Brady was almost not drafted into the NFL. He was the 200th pick in the draft, practically, 199 specifically. And people who are drafted in the position that he typically is, they have a few seasons in the league as a backup. They may never see the playing field. They get cut, and then it's just over. Yeah. And so it seemed like for a few years, Belichick was this uncompromising, brilliant football genius. And Brady was this unbelievable underdog who, the subtext of that is, I think Belichick could look at Brady and say, this kid's really special, but he's also really lucky that he gets to play for me.
Or in my system, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he was described as a system player, and that he was just, you know, don't make any mistakes and Belichick's team will win the game. But over those 20 years, Brady became not only one of the most successful players in the league, but considered by most people to be one of, if not the very greatest player to ever play. And so I wonder what you think about how much that change in the dynamic as Brady became more on equal footing and started getting equal credit to Belichick, if that was part of the problem for Belichick.
It might have been. I actually think more that, again, Belichick just misses, and this is a great work, you know, and a result. He just misses the sort of emotional, you know, component. And I think, look, Brady was always a guy out there. Look, when you have rules for rookies or first year or otherwise, you don't know what you have, right? So you have these rules and you have to follow them. When you find out that it's your most loyal, dedicated, hardworking employee, and, you know, one day they're 5 minutes late and you deride them and punish them, like, it just feels a little punitive. Like, we earn respect, we earn credit, right, based on sort of our years of service. And I don't know whether, I'm sure there was a little bit of that, but I think it was more of like Brady's like, look, like, you know, I'm going to do all the work, like, lay off, like, don't treat me like a undrafted, you know, rookie in the thing. I don't want to be special, and I'm not a prima donna, and he's never been accused of that. But like, I also have like kind of earned my seniority here, and I don't need to be treated like someone who's 20 years old. Like it's even like in parenting. Like if you would say, look, I'm going to treat my 26-year-old the same way I treated them when I was 12, because it sort of worked really well. And he was really tough on him. Yeah. I am sure that his ascension, and I'm sure there's a lot of ego at play here, but if you sort of watch this and you see the type of team player that Brady is, and that he's like, look, I sacrificed a ton. I sacrificed a ton of my individuality. And like, I'm getting to the point in my career where I want to be me and I want to do what I want to do. And if I want to go start a clothing brand, I want to start a clothing brand. If it doesn't hurt the team, like why do you care?
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Yeah, and it seems like this is the type of dynamic that happens all the time in companies of all sorts, where there is, say, in this case, we'd call Belichick like the founder and the CEO. Now, he doesn't own the team, obviously, but yeah. he has that level of control over the domain of the team.
Yeah.
And Brady is kind of like the second or like third hire who sticks around for the long haul. And they're really integral maybe to the product. They're like, maybe they're a genius programmer who built a tech platform or something right. Like that. And I do think that no matter how successful you are, you know, no matter how much you win, eventually it's really difficult for someone who is not at the head of the organization to not look around and say, well, I'm responsible for a lot of the things that we've done here. Like, I'm a little tired of answering to someone else and of being treated like a subordinate.
Yeah, like I want some equity.
Yeah. or even just like, I want to see if I can do this myself. And I want to separate myself and be recognized for my ability separate from this other person. And so I don't think that that's necessarily what happened to Brady right. With Belichick. Yeah. Although I suspect Brady, as a super competitive guy, was probably happy when he won a Super Bowl without Belichick. And people were saying, well, hey, like he won.
He's just a system quarterback, right?
Yeah. Brady can do all of his humble stuff like that he wants, and he can talk about how it doesn't matter to him. I guarantee you, like off microphone, when he's sitting around with his friends, he talks about how he got one on Belichick and won without him. That's how these guys are wired. And that applies to organizational dynamics as well. Like that's how a lot of people who have the tenacity and the grit to be a really high up person in a company, especially to survive the startup grind, they feel that way too. And they start to look around and say, what's in it for me?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, there's a lot of complications to this. The relationships are dynamic. I think you have power dynamics. I mean, the other thing of this is that there was an owner, right? And one of the narratives, Bob Kraft, you know, in this, who saw a lot of this happening. In some ways, he was kind of the founder, and he put a CEO in there, and he's trying to hold the whole thing together. He realized that he had the best quarterback in the history of the game, and he had the best coach in the history of the game. He also realized that, like, there was a lot of tension there, and you know, there was interesting his narrative trying to kind of hold it all together. And look, the one thing I thought was super interesting, and where he kind of really threw Belichick under the bus, was the example of Malcolm Butler. And Malcolm Butler was like a player who is a hero for the Patriots in the Super Bowl. A couple of years later, they're back in the Super Bowl and he just doesn't play him. He's the starting person. He doesn't play him before the game and doesn't give anyone an explanation. Butler to this day doesn't know why he doesn't play. The team doesn't know why he play. And there are some rumors of some personal thing or otherwise. And, you know, what Kraft said, look, he made a lot of these decisions and he really encouraged people. And this is a constant thing in leadership, to do things in the best interest of the team. And when you make tough decisions in the best interest of the team, you're usually transparent around that, right? Like, we decide to let Mick go because Mick has been blowing curfew and being selfish and doing all this stuff. And we would rather lose, you know, win without Mick than lose with Mick. He never provided anyone example for this. And the rumors were that it was something personal and petty. And it actually really hurt the team. Like, they couldn't stop anyone. They were missing their best defensive player. And everyone is still mad about that to this day, because it just felt like that was the time where he went against his own rules. It was clearly not in the best interest of the team. And if it was, he should have been able to articulate that to someone or to explain that to someone. It was interesting how that really was still burning negatively with many of these players, like, years later. I think they kind of felt betrayed because he had been ultimately at least consistent. They didn't agree with him before that. And that seemed kind of like a wholly inconsistent decision.
Well, and I think that it's that credibility crisis that a lot of leaders have, where I think people saw that and thought, this guy doesn't totally always practice what he's preaching. And everyone is supposed to sacrifice and put their ego below the good of the team. And he's made this decision and basically is saying, either explicitly or, you know, implicitly, that he doesn't think he owes anyone an explanation.
Yeah. That would be like pulling your core product for a week and off the market and causing all kinds of chaos and just not offering anyone an explanation of why you did it. Like, it's really hard to get people to buy into that.
Yeah. Or even if you have a really crucial, like, client sales pitch or something, and you pull someone who's responsible for 25% of the pitch off the team and just say, you're not doing it anymore. And everyone has to scramble to cover for them.
Yeah, and then none of the team gets their bonus because they didn't get the thing, right? They're going to want to understand. They need an explanation as to why you did that and why it was in the best interest of the team.
Yeah, and then if you're me, you're watching the Super Bowl at a house full of Eagles fans, and you're in hell. So thanks, Belichick.
All the ego, transitioning into the ego, right? It's all about you, man.
But so do you think that there's, in some ways, it's kind of ironic. This is a little bit of a repeat of the dynamic that you're talking about with Brady and Belichick, between Kraft and Belichick, where Belichick's basically saying, you know, look at everything I've given you. Look at all the success. Why do I have to explain myself to you?
Well, look, this is where Belichick made his bet. And this is a theme that's come up a lot. Winning hides a lot of problems. And in sports, we know what winning looks like. In businesses and other organizations, winning is usually growth, right? It's, we're growing, we're doing stuff. And when that stops, like, the tide goes out. And so there's we can talk about, there was an impact of the culture. I think the Pats culture was horrible during those last couple of years. No one was having fun, but they were winning. They were basically miserable for the whole season, winning the Super Bowl and celebrating. And, like, at some point it wasn't enough. Or that was just on the teeter of, if you don't win and everyone's that unhappy until the last game of the season, like, this is like a company where, like, it's absolutely miserable. You're just trying to get to the goal and we'll give up 10 years of our life and sacrifice to just get to the goal. Like, at some point the juice has to be worth, you know, the squeeze. So there was that dynamic. And ultimately, Belichick centralized all control under himself. He overrode personnel decisions. He overrode player decisions. Like, in most organizations, and probably why he wasn't hired as coach in these other organizations, is all these departments had to give up their authority and sort of cede to him. And the thing was, he wasn't talking to people. He wasn't, you know, taking their advice. And then they stopped winning. And so it's really hard not to put the finger on that person and say, look, and I think Kraft did the same thing. I think Kraft tolerated a lot of bad behavior from Belichick when they were winning. And as soon as they stop winning, it's really hard to defend. Like, if everyone's pissed and annoyed and thinks, you know, the person doesn't listen to them, and now you're not winning, that's really hard to defend. And there's really no one else to blame, because the problem is The coach also wanted to be the player personnel person. And you could argue that he's still been a fine coach, but he sucked at player personnel for the last 3 years in drafting, but he wasn't going to fire himself. So that sort of put the Kraft, you know, the CEO, in an all or nothing decision, saying, look, this person wants to run all these departments. They're awesome at marketing, but they won't give up sales and they won't give up finance. So like, I need to make an all or nothing decision here.
Yeah. And I do think that there is another analog to certainly entrepreneurial founders. It is very interesting that Belichick is the ultimate, you know, be aware of everything, always be improving on the margins, like be aware of your weaknesses, guard against your weaknesses, keep getting better. And it's so funny to me that for all of that sort of growth mindset element that he has, that he can't see that maybe his complete control over everything is part of the problem.
Yeah. And look, this is like if the CEO of the company says, look, I need to overrule your hiring on your team, right? Apparently, a couple of the scouts were really upset at him for overruling draft picks. And, you know, they couldn't draft a wide receiver in the last 5 years, and they tried. And apparently, a few years ago, they wanted, had two receivers in. It was Deebo Samuel and AJ, now I'm forgetting his name, on the who went to the Eagles.
AJ Brown.
AJ Brown, who both ended up being superstars. And apparently they knew each other and they were in for the Pats interview and they were kind of laughing and talking to each other because they knew each other. And Belichick didn't like that they weren't stoic and serious on their visit. And so he kind of overruled the staff. And instead of drafting one or two all-star players, they drafted two or three. And so this is like, again, when you don't let people flank your weaknesses and you kind of overrule them. Again, imagine an organization where the CEO is like, look, I get to decide who's on your team, right, at the end of the day, and pick who's on your team. Now, there's only one kind of team here, so you could argue everyone's an executive team. But those become tough decisions. I mean, you can't be surprised if you're Belichick after, you know, three losing seasons in a row where you make all of the decisions that's not going to fly, right?
And I would be curious for your perspective on this, but I would wager, you know, those scouts probably wanted Belichick to draft some people who were not worth the selection. And actually, he overruled them and it was for the best. But they remember the ones where they were not listened to and they were right in hindsight. I suspect, I'd be curious for your thought about this, that when you're in that top leadership seat, you're always going to have people coming to you saying, well, I thought we should have done this and you thought we should have done that and I was right. But you're not going to have someone coming to you saying, yeah, that time I wanted to draft that guy, terrible decision. Thank you for saving me from myself.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I also think they probably just want to feel like they're heard and their value and their input. I think sometimes people make their decisions, but they make people feel heard. And in another case, they make people feel not heard or dismissed or sort of overrule with their logic. You know, you're going to have decisions that not everyone is going to be happy about. But I think there's a lot of that going on kind of the organization. And there was kind of a lot of fear, you know, towards the end. And the other thing he did, you know, is, as you know, like he didn't name official coordinators. Like most people have an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. And like, it kind of is it's a recognition of what they're doing, right? It's kind of like having a CFO and saying, well, that person's special finance person for our team. Like they're like, kind of like, no, I'm running the books. Like I want to be the CFO. Like, because if I want another job, I want people to know I have a CFO. And his predecessor actually is kind of undoing that. But it also just seemed again, like a not giving anyone else power or the right title for what they were doing and keeping it all very amorphous and under his control.
And so I think that it's not a coincidence that this long spanning reign that New England had with Belichick at the helm that has been undone in the past few years. And as you mentioned, he's not with the team anymore. He was effectively fired.
And effectively the winningest coach ever, not hired by any other team, because one of the places he was rumored to go was Atlanta. And Atlanta has this great GM who doesn't like him. And basically, like, is the Atlanta GM going to fire himself so that he can hire a new coach? Like, that's a very weird proposition to be put in.
And so I think, though, that it's really hard to ignore the fact that that 20-year span coincided with some really interesting changes in workplace dynamics in what is considered acceptable about leadership. And he seems like a pretty classic, to borrow terms that you use a lot. You know, he's a pretty classic command and control, do as I say leader. But he also has a little bit of that churn and burn hypergrowth approach too, where everyone's expendable and he's always changing the parts out.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the proposition that part of the reason that the team fell apart and part of the reason that he wasn't able to get another job this past offseason is that people are just less interested in investing in that type of leadership style now?
Yeah. So I think there is some truth to that. I think there's multiple things. I think if you look at the first three championships in the first wave, they had this core of veteran leaders. It's like middle management. They had really good middle management that bought into the system and bought into the culture. And they are the ones who taught the Patriot way to rookies and people coming in and sort of like, I always say this to people in the organization today, like it's actually the middle man, the people who the culture lives out with them every day, right? You can't have the upper level talking to every new employee. Like that middle is kind of the key piece. And they had that in the first run. And in the second run, they didn't. And there was a lot of kind of, again, they were still winning, but there was a lot of negativity or otherwise. And I really think that he doesn't relate to the players of today. They don't have the winning. They don't, and he doesn't have those people to who believe in him and the system enough to then get the younger people to buy in. So as he gets older, I think it's less relatable. Also, things change, right? The league defense used to win. Now it's a run and shoot. It's a wide receiver, you know, league, and they haven't drafted a wide receiver in 10 years. Like you just, it's really hard to do the same thing for that long and have it always work. But sometimes it works until it doesn't. And again, I think that's because a lot of things were hidden by winning. And as soon as the winning stopped, the dam sort of broke for better or for worse.
Yeah. And I think relating to that, the idea of the middle management being the people who are winning the hearts and minds in the organization. There was a quote, I think it was from Danny Amendola, who was with the team for like 5 years in there. And I think his quote was, we worked for Bill, we played for Tom. And so, so Tom Brady had that, he was effectively that hearts and minds winner. And I think part of the reason that the team culture fell apart was because he was less bought in and he was sort of starting to look at the exit and then he wasn't there anymore. And I do think that what relates to that and ties into that is as the person at the head of the organization, you have to know that those people in the middle of the org chart are the ones who are winning hearts and minds. And so you really need to make sure that they're bought in and that they're on the bus. And it seems like Belichick kind of lost focus on that element of it because his understanding was, this is just the way people are going to be bought in or they're not going to stay here.
And I had this discussion, you know, with someone recently in a business context, which is you can have really high expectations and you can be tough and have a high bar if people believe that you genuinely care about them, right? And I think this is where he just doesn't seem to have this emotional gene. It's just not, again, I think other people have failed trying to be him because I just think it's kind of how he is. And I think that works in certain contexts. And you see a little bit of this with Elon Musk or otherwise, and some people who are geniuses, right? Who are missing kind of a social emotional context or filter or read the room. And so I think when he was closer to the players and knew them better, I think they felt that more. I think some of them started to question that. Like, does he really care about me? You know, am I expendable? I think people can live with those high standards and they can even say, look, this isn't going to work, but like, I love you and let me help you find another team to be on versus feeling like there's no, you know, there's no sort of connection. And you know, one of the core power plays that Belichick did that's talked about in this, which just seems so unnecessary. And I actually think really alienated that entire group of people in addition to Brady, was the situation with Alex Guerrero. So those of you who followed Brady, like ever since he got hurt, he went into this thing called pliability, changed his diet. His entire workout was focused on, and everyone says quarterbacks can't last, you know, more than to 40 years old. And that was the thing, but he went this whole kind of strategy and it really seemed to work. Like he looked ageless, and he was playing in 44. He was doing things that no one had done before. And he credited Alex doing all this body work with him and this nutrition plan and everything. And some other people on the team also started having trouble, including Rob Gronkowski, who got hurt. And then this thing said, look, I tried everything. Until I went to Alex, I never started to feel better. I thought I was going to get cut from the team. And so people started going to this guy, and Brady had him coming with him on the jet and team and work with him every day. And it became a power struggle. And Belichick didn't like that they were going to non-team trainers, even though it was helping all of them. And they were like getting back on the field. And he just unilaterally banned Alex Guerrero from coming on the Patriots playing with the team otherwise. And this was sort of the beginning of the end, the falling out, because it was just a power play move, right? You have Brady playing into 44, 45 years old with this guy's help and body is like holding up and other people. And that seemed to be one of those moves that had no real, again, you couldn't say you were doing it for the team. It didn't really have any justification other than I just won a championship. And again, we haven't dug into this, but like we've talked about what winning covers problems, but winning also is a huge challenge with egos. Because when you win and you get it right and things fall into place, then you tend to think you're right about a whole bunch of other things as well.
Yeah, it is funny because the Alex Guerrero thing that you were just describing is kind of like a longer term playing out version of the Malcolm Butler thing. It was a power play and he had the power to do it. And so he did. And there were some pretty serious breakages of trust and of respect with the team because of that.
Yeah, it just seemed so unnecessary, right? I mean, this is like personal training. Like, what is it? If it keeps him healthy and performing at a high level and you're getting the outcomes, why are you attacking the method? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. So picking up on something you just mentioned, a major theme is about sacrifice and how hard it can be to continue sacrificing and sustaining winning once you've reached the top of the mountaintop. Because that seems like a pretty clear parallel with another thing you talk about a lot of you climb the mountain and you look around and you're like, what's next for me?
Yeah. Look, winning is not the only thing. Some of the players were saying, look, we were basically killing ourselves and not enjoying our lives and not having fun to win that one last game, right? That kind of feels like grinding your company, doing whatever, selling it or taking it public. And looking around and be like, I just lost all this time with my kids. I lost my family. I'm divorced. Like, was it worth it? Right? Like, does the ends justify the means? And it's great to have those goals. But I think, you know, my analogy I use sort of with the Elevate Your Team thing is like, you know, if NASA decided that they're going to put a space shuttle on the Mars and it lands on Mars and all the astronauts are dead, I don't think people are going to be jumping up and down and cheering. Like, the goal is to put, you know, a crew and put a vehicle on Mars, but also have the humans kind of survive along with it and not, you know, survive the journey. So, you know, it's kind of a souped up analogy, but there were so many interesting things about winning and that I learned about. And one, again, winning can cover up a lot of problems. They are uncovered as soon as the winning stops, similar to growth. I think, you know, winning oftentimes becomes too much the only thing. And then again, that also causes some cultural problems. But there's this other one when we're right. Like someone told me a few weeks ago that the worst thing that ever happened to them was that they really got some major decisions right a couple times in a row. And then what happened was they doubled down and like destroyed the whole thing like after that because they didn't factor in the luck and the timing. And they said the best thing that ever happened to me and the worst thing that ever happened to me was I was right. And I suspect when Belichick won that last Super Bowl, even in this midst of kind of cultural chaos and everyone was calling him a defensive genius because he got them to completely switch their system from the whole season in 2 weeks against the team, it sort of fed his ego. And he was like, see, I'm right. And I should make all these decisions and I don't need this quarterback. And like, it was ego stoking in a way that kind of led to the eventual downfall.
Yeah. And so something you just said about people discounting or not thinking about the role of luck. And actually, to the point you made at the beginning.
And this timing.
But this is why I think sports is such a relevant example, is because the role of luck is so visible in sports. And sometimes you do everything right and you have this incredible season and you don't win in the end. Sometimes if you're Brady, you throw for over 500 yards in the Super Bowl and you lose because the other team scored more. Sometimes you have a nearly perfect season and then recent Elevate podcast guests, David Tyree, catches the ball off of his head and you lose.
And the story will be told totally differently, right? Based on that one play. And you may not know this. So there's very few statistics I can give you, but you queued this up possibly. But do you know what the biggest predictor of a team's turnaround from season to season is? How they can predict statistically how a team's going to do much better?
What is it?
That they lost an abnormal amount of very close games, right? Like,
yeah.
You lost like six games by 4 points or less. Like, you just, it didn't go your way. Like, and that the chips are just bound to go the other way at some point.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think to the point of the destination versus the journey, getting that destination to play out in your favor, it's really precarious. And if you have a couple of those near misses that really sting, it can be hard to put in that same grind and say, okay, well, on to the next one. Maybe we'll win the whole thing next year. I guess I'll be miserable for the next 11 months.
And history is written by the victors, right? So again, and that might be a tenth of a degree, a point, a tip pass or whatever. And if you win it, you get to tell the entire story of how you did everything right. And if it went the other way, someone else could come up with a completely different narrative of basically the same story.
Yeah, and this stuff can be unraveled really quickly. Like maybe you've the perfect product market fit for a certain environment, and just when you're getting to the point where you're ready to go public or sell the company, something changes in the market that completely upends your strategy. And if you have this thriving company culture where people love to work and everyone feels like you're in it together, everyone can kind of pull together and say, look, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing and hope our luck evens out in the end. But if you're completely miserable and you're in this hyper growth thing where everyone's working Marissa Meyer 130-hour yeah. work weeks, that's just those losses and those turns in luck are devastating because the destination wasn't worth it. It didn't work out.
Yeah. And look, one thing I'd be remiss that I want to make sure we mention is the relationship side, in that a lot of this documentary and a lot of the criticism was focused on the negatives of this, you know, relationship. However, Brady and Belichick, while they clearly were not speaking by the end or had their problems or otherwise, have said nothing but positive things about each other and the love they have for each other in public. Brady says he's the best coach ever. Belichick says he's the best player ever, despite that. And when they asked Brady in the thing, like how they would describe his relationship with Belichick and the whole thing experience over 20 years, he got pretty choked up and he said it was perfect. And I don't think he was like he just talked about a lot of the struggles. I don't think he was being disingenuous by saying it's perfect, but what he was sort of looking at was this body of work and what they accomplished together. And in any long-term relationship, you have problems and you fight, and otherwise are partnerships. Like it doesn't mean that the relationship isn't net positive overall. It didn't produce, you know, if you videoed my wife and I's worst moments, like, you know, in a documentary, like it's not going to look very good. You're going to miss some context, but I think that was missing in the narrative around, look, relationships are complicated. They have their ups and downs, but like, I don't think the two of them regret anything. And I think they appreciate like what it's like they raised this family together that went on to be successful. I think they appreciate everything they did. And could certain things have gone better or the end or otherwise? Yeah, probably. But I think this expectation that, and the title was called Imperfect Dynasty, that anything is perfect is impossible to live up to.
Yeah, if you're willing to look at things in the big picture, the picture looks a lot better in a lot of cases, if you're lucky. I feel bad to some degree, even though I've taken kind of an anti-Belichick stance throughout this podcast. I feel bad because I can't imagine what it must be like to have the 85 most important people in your life be on a documentary and get filmed for like an hour and a half, and they pull out the like 2 seconds where they said something that they really didn't like about you.
Yeah, and the players have been very vocal all over the Boston sports radio waves around the other stuff that they said and that, look, but they should have known that, you know, what sells. But I think that's interesting. And, you know, you had asked this question, like, do relationships have an expiration date? You know, professional relationships, no matter how successful they are. I think this is a universal thing in terms of relationships or personal. I think there are natural inflection points in relationships, all relationships, and you either inflect together or you inflect apart, but something changes and you either kind of move in that direction or not. And so I think there was multiple times where they kind of went in the same direction. And I think this last inflection point, they decided to go, you know, in a different relationship. But again, ending is trickier here versus because like the player has to retire or do something or, you know, and going on to another team is not necessarily the end of a relationship. I mean, they probably still have that relationship, but I do think things needed to change, you know, for at least one of them.
Yeah. And that is an important caveat that if Brady could have played quarterback for another 20 years, maybe Belichick would have been willing to work it out with him. But I think that both of them basically looked at and said, you know, my career is almost over. I'm going to do something else.
Right. I want to have fun. And Belichick's like, I'm going to need another quarterback for the next 7 years. So I got to make these decisions, right? One of the things that really strained the relationship was he drafted his successor, right? And no one likes to see that. But in an organization, it's your job to build successors.
Yeah, no, totally. So the million-dollar question, the last question before we get to the quote of the week. Who is more responsible for the dynasty, Brady or Belichick?
Yeah, this is the trap question. Look, I think it was the combination and the teamwork that produced that lasting success. And I don't think either would have been successful for a longer period without the other. It's just kind of like this, you get this beautiful relationship. With that said, Belichick's record without Brady is a losing record, and Brady did go on to win one Super Bowl without him. So there's that small piece of data, but it doesn't change my answer.
I think Belichick carries the first three, and I think Brady carries the second three by a whisper.
I would agree with that assessment.
I think it's half and half, but in kind of a different way. So the quote of the week is from Vince Lombardi. Perfection is not attainable, but if we chase perfection, we can catch excellence. Why'd you pick this quote?
So I thought, first of all, Vince Lombardi is one of the most successful coaches of all time. In fact, the NFL Championship Award is named after him. But I think this is an interesting concept in that we've also written about, like, perfection is debilitating, right? Like, you know, people who demand perfectionism and strive for perfectionism. So I kind of like this, like, it's not attainable, but like if you chase really high things, if you have really high standards and you're just a little below that, you're still going to be at a super high level. And I think that's a really interesting concept. And it sort of states like, yeah, you're not always going to meet that goal and you shouldn't beat yourself up or otherwise, but the outcome's still going to be pretty good versus chasing mediocrity. So I think he stated that as well as it's been stated.
Well said. Want to take us home?
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for listening today and for putting up with our endless sports analogies, although I think they really were leadership and organizational analogies. And I would encourage everyone to watch the documentary. I really think you'll learn a lot about high-performing team and people and ego. And like I said, I have referenced this construct in some of the things in discussions that had nothing to do with sports over the last couple of weeks. So if you want to check out the post we just discussed, go to robertglazer.substack.com and look for the most recent post titled Imperfect Dynasty. And keep your eye out for future editions of Weekend Conversations, which will be in your feed every Saturday morning. And if you haven't subscribed to the show, please follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast app, as that's how you get notified about the new episodes. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.